Hi, everyone, and welcome to another VibrationsOfTheSoul.com podcast. My name is Terry, and today I have a special guest with me, and his name is Jerry Marzinski. This is Jerry's second interview with VibrationsOfTheSoul.com, but I also have other amazing guests with me here today who are also interested in this subject matter that we're going to be discussing. So thank you all from the bottom of my heart for being here. I appreciate you taking the time on a holiday, no less. I'd like to introduce and tell you a little bit about Jerry. He's a licensed psychotherapist with over 35 years of experience working with schizophrenic and other psychiatric patients in state hospitals, state prisons, and hospital emergency rooms. Jerry worked in one of the largest psychiatric hospitals called Central State Hospital, located in Georgia. And this is where he spent the first 7 years of his career studying the voices that those labeled psychotic heard. His formal academic training comprises a BA in psychology from Temple University, a master's degree in counseling from the University of Georgia, and 2 years of study in a PhD psychology program. So he joins us here today because it is his second interview with us to talk about his new book called An Amazing Journey into the Psychotic Mind, Breaking the Spell of the Ivory Tower. And he wrote that. His co-author was Sherry Sweeney. He's also here to discuss his discoveries while practicing as a psychotherapist and why he began to question the psychiatric medical authorities and their view on treatment and diagnosis of mental illness. So what makes Jerry wonderfully unique is through his own direct experiences and his own self-discovery in his own journey. He talks about how we are all affected by the voices or these entities working through our own minds through thought control, or we can call them thought injections, and how we actually think that they're our own. Jerry's website is jerrymarzinski.com, and you can go to his website to purchase his new book, which is amazing. So thank you, Jerry, for being here. I really, really appreciate it.
Well, thank you for having me. The last time I talked to a crowd this big, I was in the state prison. Talking to criminally insane ex-cons.
Right. Well, reading through your book, and thank you for sending that to me, by the way, reading through your book, it was a powerful read, because when I started to come into the understanding of the barbaric treatments that have been done to people, it just breaks your heart to see the abuse and the atrocities that have been done to people who, quote, have mental illness. And I thought you just did a wonderful job in your book from bringing a history into your own discovery and journey and your own insights and how you moved that in through the predator mind and to explain that, and then how you moved into suggestions for people in terms of ways that they can also help themselves. And I just thought it was wonderfully done and a powerful read. So I hope everybody who's listening will take the time to read Jerry's book. It was great. Perhaps we can start there, and you can tell me about what the motivation was to write your book, and then also some views on the psychiatric medical model and big pharma. And I know that's a big conversation, but let's just start there, work through it, and then I'd like everybody else as we go in just very informal way to be able to ask questions and contribute whatever you think is meaningful from your heart for our conversation.
Yeah, and feel free to jump in at any time, because, you know, I learned stuff from listening to you guys. You know, like Jules last time we talked, she talked about an experience she had, which is something I had floating around in my mind from different sources I've read, and she's actually experienced that. So I'm like, wow, here's somebody who's actually been there. And so that, you know, that helped solidify my thinking on that issue. Well, where to start? I guess to start would be my...
Your book.
Well, the book came about because a lot of people were asking for it. You know, when are you going to write a book? You know, where's the book? You should write a book. And Sherry and I looked at that and went, Well, yeah, they can, YouTube can get rid of everything we put on the channel electronically. They can erase all this stuff at the push of a button, but they won't be able to get rid of the book once it's in physical form and out. It'll be out there. So we started working on one that took us like 4 years, you know, to get this to this point. And we were like two people tied together with chains and beating each other over the head. And no, this is more important than that. And no, not, that's not exactly how that happened. Oh, yes, it is. I mean, but Sherry actually was there. She struggled with these voices as a young woman for many years until she figured out a way to get rid of them. And the way we met is that, you know, I didn't like what I saw going on in the state prison when I was working there. I think I worked there for like 17 years in the psych department, the whole time studying the voice of schizophrenics. And Sherry had a prison reform group, the biggest in the United States. And what I'd done was develop a computer-assisted program where we could pass out booklets and test the prisoners over what these different topics, you know, drug abuse, alcohol abuse, parenting, codependency, all these things that they needed to know to rehabilitate and to recover. The problem we had is they cheated on everything, and they were good cheaters. I mean, some of the ways that they cheated were just unbelievable, you know, not just, you know, writing answers on their hands, but inside of see-through pens, they would have the answers inside the pens, and just incredible ways to cheat. So the only way to stop that would be to watch them closely, and then you'd have to confront a, you know, potentially unstable prisoner about cheating, and that never went over real well. So my wife's a computer programmer, and I said, well, is there a way we can develop a program that randomly gives, presents both the questions and the answers? So each time the question comes up, it's a different configuration that they can't cheat on because it's constantly random. That almost caused a divorce over the years. But yeah, she did develop something like that. So they'd go in, we'd hand them a booklet, you know, and it would be one of, you know, with alcohol education, 14 different booklets over different aspects. They'd take it to their cell, they'd study it, and that took them hours. So they stayed out of trouble. They weren't out there pushing drugs and beating everybody up and being bored and causing trouble. They were studying. They were doing something productive. And then they'd come back in and they'd hand that booklet back in. That was their ticket to take the test on the computer. And they couldn't cheat on the computer. So they'd finish that. The computer would grade it, score it, and data bank their test score. And then they'd be given the next one. We were processing hundreds and hundreds of inmates that way. I mean, it was the best rehabilitation program the prison system ever had. So, you know, they awarded me, what it was, I still have the stupid badge here, made in China. The state meritorious award for something or other. So yeah, I got called to Phoenix, and then a couple of months later, here were the people that were running this, the counselors who were running this program in the prison, actually turned it over to inmate trustees to run. And what they were doing was scamming it and turning it into a big scam where you pay that inmate trustee a Coke or cigarettes or candy bars or whatever, and he'll pass that test for you because he had the encrypted password. And this became not just, you know, on one unit, it was happening on all the units because the prison staff were too friggin' lazy to just turn on the computers and sit there and watch for an hour while the computers did all the work. They'd rather go down there, start the things, and then turn it over to the inmates. So it became huge, and finally, some of the wardens wouldn't bring it under control, so I went up to Phoenix and told the head lady there, I said, you need to stop this. You've got the biggest scam going in the universe. You need to do something about this. She looked at me and she said, no, you don't tell us what to do. We tell you what to do. I said, not in this case. And this, the programming that powers these things are copyrighted. And my wife's name, either run it right or shut it down. It shut down over $10,000 worth of computers back then. These were used computers, so there were a lot of them. Just for that. So that's how I met Sherry. You know. told her, Sherry, we got this thing. Let other prisons know. But prisons are dark places. They don't want anything, nothing good that happens in there goes unpunished. So the prisons are a place where these dark entities have control. They have virtually complete control, and anything good that's done in there, you'll pay for it. So that's how I met Sherry. And then we started comparing, you know, I was telling her about one case of a schizophrenic guy I was working with, a prisoner, an odd case. And she goes, oh, I know all about that. And this is 10 years after I met her. She goes, I know all about that. I've heard voices. And I couldn't believe it because she was one of the most spiritually advanced people I knew. So I started pounding her with questions that only somebody who heard voices would know. Bam. And she'd write back, you know, right back. Bam, 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 bam. All of them. And I just sat there dumbfounded. I was like, how could this be? How could you know? I know you for 10 years and you haven't mentioned a word of this. That just goes to show you there is no positive outcome for people who hear voices to tell anybody else about them. You know, you look what happens to them when they do. And Sherry is a case in point. You know, you tell your friends and you go, oh, you hear voices, you're weird. I mean, something's wrong with you. Those are demons or you're possessed or, you know, and they start backing away. So they tell the parents and parents get all upset and, you know, they're behaving strangely. And well, we're going to drag you to the psychiatrist. And they take them to the psychiatrist. Oh, you're hearing voices? Well, you're crazy. You're psychotic. You know, your brain's broken due to a chemical brain imbalance, and there's no proof for that whatsoever. Matter of fact, it's been disproved over and over and over again, but it sells drugs, and that's what the chemical companies and the drug companies want. So they came up with that, Eli Lilly did, back in the 70s when they came out with Prozac, and they knew it was a lie at the time. And they knew there was nothing to it. But they went, well, if we can convince people that they have a chemical brain imbalance, then it's logical that they would take some kind of chemical to balance that imbalance. And that sold a lot more drugs. So that's what they did. And then they influenced Congress. They influenced medical schools. The medical schools back in the 30s, they took control of Congress and the medical schools and made it mandatory that any medical school who was going to get licensed would have to teach pharmaceutical-based treatments. That's it. So all the other treatments that they had at the time, electrical treatments and neuropathy and all the other treatments that were prolific back then, just shriveled up because, you know, doctors would say, oh, that's a scam. That's what they call it. They had a name for it. But basically, they label it tomfoolery. You know, it's a bunch of garbage. And they promoted that. And so all those things went down the drain.
And Jerry, it's heavily promoted today. I mean, nothing changes. It seems like it's just more and more and more ingrained. Every time you turn on television, there's another commercial or an advertisement for another antidepressant or for some other type of medication to shift your state of consciousness with smiling, happy people walking hand in hand. And it's terrible. It's awful to watch, to see, and to know that. And again, and we've talked before, I mean, this is just not, schizophrenics are at the high end of that curve, right? Where they are, whether you call it possession or attachment, but there's high direct communication. But every single person here has had this experience where there has been voices and input, but for some reason, and probably based on trauma, like we've talked about, because you said the majority of schizophrenics are, you know, trauma, sexual traumas and things like that, where their consciousness, their soul is so damaged that these entities or voices or beings come into their consciousness stream. And I think all of us here, we've worked, I mean, every single person here, we've worked to like move through this and jump in here, anybody, but move through like coming in through this filter where we're coming from deep pain or sorrow or disconnection from what do you want to call it, source of the divine, to find a way to synthesize and move, I call it vertical, into the heart where we can get outside of that influence. Wouldn't you guys agree?
Yeah, so I would definitely agree there. And what I really appreciate about what you're saying, Jerry, is, you know, you mentioned YouTube censorship. You've mentioned, you know, the fallen systems in the prison. You've mentioned the medical system as a fallen system, the chemical lies that were being fed, you know, and this, I think it almost seems that, you know, that this has all been produced, you know, to what purpose into this death culture that we've basically been induced into. And what I love about your work is that you've not only hit on that what's a lie program, but we can also, I feel, begin to bring that also, and would you agree that we could also begin to bring this into just finally listening to the voices that we know that aren't ours, but also be able to incorporate this some type also into our own self-empowerment in our own daily lives?
Yeah, good point there. You've hit on several points there. And one of the most pertinent, I think, that has been totally ignored by psychology and psychiatry and the medical industry is, where do thoughts come from? And what are they and where do they come from? And that's what I went into school looking for. You know, I didn't find it in undergraduate psychology. I didn't find it in the master's program. And finally, after 2 years in the PhD program, the head of the psych department asked if anybody had any questions over anything. And I had one that I'd been waiting for them to answer for 2 years, and they didn't. So, you know, I raised my hand and I said, hey, where do thoughts come from? And the guy looked at me, the head of the department, like I was a Martian that had just fallen at his feet out of a flying saucer. It's like, who asks those kind of questions? You know, and it's like everybody has thoughts. You know, so, and the assumption is that they all belong to you. You know, that if you have the thought, it's your thought. But when you start studying schizophrenics, and the psychiatry has labeled schizophrenia a thought disorder. Do you think they've done a single solitary study on the thoughts that schizophrenics have? No, not at all. There's no studies done at all. They just all of a sudden come out with infinite arrogance and go, we hereby proclaim, because we don't hear these things and nobody else seems to, that schizophrenics are nuts and you know, they're insane, and what they're hearing is auditory hallucinations. And that's it. And any schizophrenic who tries to tell them otherwise, saying that, no, these are real. They speak in complete sentences. They speak in complete thoughts. They're very nasty. They're very real. They're not real. They're auditory hallucinations, and it's due to the fact that you have a chemical imbalance in your brain. And before that, it was your mother fed you the wrong foods, and before that it was genetics, and they always have some, like a kaleidoscope, some to make it look like they know what schizophrenia is and where it came from and what causes it, and they know nothing. They know nothing. They have no idea what causes it, where it comes from, or anything about it other than their medicines suppress the symptoms. They don't cure.
So Jerry, tell us a little bit about who those voices are and where they're coming from and what they're about.
Let me get into the normal thing first. Is everybody hears a voice in their head. Okay. So everybody's got their own program. And if you're thinking, you're running a program. And you're running a program based on all your experiences of the past, your mom, your dad, school, whatever you've gone through in the past, is that program that's running over and over and over again. And when that program is done running, the world is the way you think it is. So one thing I saw at the state hospital was there were odd things happening all the time. And I'd see those things and I'd go, well, that was odd, that was weird. And then 2 weeks later, I wouldn't remember it. And so I went, well, I better write that down. And then at that time I was reading Carlos Castaneda. Basically what he said was that when something like that pops into your awareness that's strange and doesn't fit in, you're going to either try to explain it, you're going to try to fit it in with what you know and integrate it, or you're going to pound a square peg into a round hole and make it fit, or you're going to forget it.
Jerry, so, Jerry, that, in your book, you actually quote him on page 72 with Castaneda quoting Don Juan Matis. Can I just read this? Because sure. I think this is really fantastic. So Don Juan Matis was a Yaqui Indian shaman and states that these predators give us their mind. Page 72 of Jerry's new book. We have a predator that came from the depths of the cosmos and took over the rule of our lives. Human beings are its prisoners. The predator has rendered us docile and helpless. If we want to protest, it suppresses our protest. If we want to act independently, it demands that we do not do so. They took us over because we are food for them, and they squeeze us mercilessly because we are their sustenance. Think for a moment and tell me how you would explain the contradictions between the intelligence of man, the engineer, and the stupidity of his systems of beliefs, or the stupidity of his contradictory behavior. Sorcerers believe that the predators have given us our system of belief, our ideas of good and evil, our social mores, in order to keep us obedient and meek and weak. The predator engaged themselves in a stupendous maneuver, stupendous, of course, from the point of view of a fighting strategist, a horrendous maneuver from the point of view of those who suffer it. They gave us their mind. And then Jerry wrote in here, this should not come as a surprise if you consider that we all experience many of the same negative and demeaning thoughts that overwhelm schizophrenics.
So that fits into what you see going around right now as you look out in society with the communist Chinese. I mean, I got out of there a trip to China right before all this hit, and those guys have millions of cameras everywhere. I mean, everywhere. I've never saw so many cameras in my life, watching everything, every move everybody made. And they're under control. You know, they're wiping out people's houses and forcing them to move so they can make a profit and put up their own buildings. There's millions of people disrupted by the floods right now. They're not getting hardly any help whatsoever. So, and then you look at what the drug companies are doing. They're turning everybody and drugging them silly, you know, so they don't think for themselves and relieve the burden of consciousness. It's the same thing Castaneda was talking about. And, you know, these drug companies, I mean, you look at, turn on the TV, you get bombarded by all these drug commercials, you know, with all these things they make up. And that's exactly what psychiatry has done. Every single one of those mental illnesses that they've made up, I think, what is it, 347 of them now or something like that, every single one is completely made up. There is not a biological, physiological test for any of them. There's no electronic test for any of them. There's no EEG or EKG or any other kind of test for these psychiatric disorders. You know, it's just psychiatry getting up there and going, wait, you got this. And we got a drug for it.
Jerry, what do you see with the COVID situation going on right now?
Well, I see the mainstream media acting just like a bunch of psychotic voices that are attacking any schizophrenic patient, screaming bloody murder, you're going to die, be afraid, you know, do what we say. If I were to be able to play you guys, a bunch of schizophrenic voices screaming at a patient. That's exactly what the mainstream media is doing right now to everybody. You know, oh, you're going to die. Be afraid. Look at all these deaths. As a matter of fact, if you go to Google, I think it is right now, and you just type in, what is it, any string of numbers?
You better put something. You type in three numbers, any three numbers, and you put like cases or. Yeah, current
that's
case, something like that, and it'll pull up something somewhere.
Yep, it'll pull up all these cases that match that number somewhere on the planet.
Right.
So it's a control tactic. You know, if they can keep you fearful, if they can keep you drugged up, people are going to go, okay, yeah, protect us. We'll give you the control. We'll do whatever you say. And look at these guys wearing masks. I mean, I was in California not too long ago. They blocked off all the beaches. They blocked off all the parks. They blocked off all the parking lots. But they let these guys riot in the streets. And here's a quarter mile long protest going on with these people shoulder to shoulder, screaming and hollering, Black Lives Matter, beating the crap out of each other. But yet they're preventing people from going to the beach. Well, it was unbelievable. And that's these very same things that we're talking about.
And then bringing in a vaccine, right? They're trying to bring in a vaccine. Yeah.
Bill Gates and his vaccines. I mean, matter of fact, I think the Russians have put an arrest warrant out for him. If he shows up over there, they're going to get him. And they said that before Bill Gates got to Africa, there was no AIDS before he started doing his injections for AIDS. Now, Bill Gates donated $1 billion to bring down the world population. And he expects us to trust him to produce vaccines for us. And he's pushing to have everybody vaccinated. You know? And they're not listing what's in those vaccines. And there's a very high correlation between autism and Bill Gates' vaccines. But the mainstream media won't let that out.
I would like to add too, I mean, it's my understanding there's an arrest warrant for him in India too because of all the deaths. But it's like anytime you want to discuss about Bill Gates, why would he have any say over my body? It's like if you want to talk about a computer virus, okay, maybe chat with the man, but any virus for a human or a body that he has absolutely zero say, and why are we taking direction from a man other than his billions of dollars? But people get so up in arms and really, really feel like he's so helpful and, oh, this foundation and, oh, he's doing this. And it's like, no, he's not.
He's a wolf in sheep's clothing, he is.
This is why you're my hero. You're my hero, Jerry, because you're willing to speak up and stand up with us and with that we're willing to see the truth and be able to do our own inner self and work and empowerment through recognizing these voices, seeing the systems and the fallen systems that are in place. So this is why you're my hero, and you've been in the thick of it through everything that you've been through. And so I just want to express my appreciation for that. And so thank you for answering my questions.
You know, I'm just an old beat up psychotherapist that don't have a lot of years left. So you guys are the guys, you're the young guys who are going to have to get this information out, because Sherry's older than I am. We're not going to be around for a long time. And I wouldn't be surprised if the drug companies don't like me a whole lot.
We love you. So
you guys aren't the guys that are going to go after me, though. It's those guys. Yeah. So you were asking about the thoughts. Where do they come from? Well, your programming is one of the big places they come from. Where you came from, what you experienced, what you learned, your parents, your friends, all that kind of stuff keeps playing over and over and over again. So you've got that stuff going on in your head. And what's interesting about it is that it comes up from a subconscious level. Matter of fact, the recent experiments they've done is that they've noticed that there's an electrical brain activity before anybody either ever gets a thought with an intention. And so here's this firing of brain cells, and then all of a sudden this thought arises from the subconscious and comes to the conscious in conjunction. So here's this one-to-one correlation between brain electrical activity and a thought appearing out of nowhere with an intention. Now that's where free will comes in. You can act on that intention or not act on that intention. So you have the freedom to choose that. But when that process is hijacked by these entities who have complete control of your memory, and all of a sudden your mind starts getting flooded with negative memories all the time.
And these are the entities you're talking about.
Yes. And they hit everybody. They don't just hit schizophrenics. They're more noticeable with schizophrenics. And the schizophrenics experience them as voices. Now, psychologists and psychiatrists and the rest of us all hear a voice in our head. The difference is the intention. The intention of the voices that schizophrenics hear is malicious. And the thoughts or what the voices say is consistently negative. So what I noticed when I went to work at the state hospital, the first thing was that insane guys do crazy stuff. They do real crazy stuff. And it's always dangerous and self-destructive and self-sabotaging and either hurts them or hurts somebody else, but it's always negative. One of the first things I remember is when a psychotic guy cutting off his penis and they sewed it back on again, and that was the talk of the lunchroom, the hospital lunchroom for weeks, whether was it going to take or not. So they were doing stuff like that. They were slitting their wrists. They were drinking poison. They were doing all kinds of destructive stuff. They brought in a pilot who, he was flying airplanes, and he murdered his wife because he was convinced that she was turning their son into a homosexual. I mean, this guy was flying airplanes. So there was all this strange stuff happening, and I'm like, well, why? Why are they doing these things? And it flew in the face of behavior modification stuff, you know, where all organisms seek pleasure or favorable circumstances and avoid that kind of stuff. So what was wrong with these guys? Where they were seeking negative stuff, where they were doing bad things all the time. What went wrong?
So it brings in a good question, Jerry. I just thought of this. So, you know, we are our programming through our parents, you know, and our environment. So when our critical factor kicks in at the age of 7 to 11, when do these entities actually start to attach? And I mean, and we all have levels of abuse at some point, you know, so whether it's sexually or physically or mentally, we've all been abused at some point. When do you find, and like, what was your youngest patient? What was the youngest that you felt that these entities were actually attached and it almost sounds like a full possession in some of these cases?
Well, in some cases I worked with, it was, you know, the voices had complete control. You know, I've got stories of that. It shocked me. When I was working in the ERs, the last 10 years I worked, when I was doing psych crisis in the ERs, and we had to cover the children's units also, it shocked me how many kids were actually hearing voices. I didn't think that they did until one after another, they started coming in. And yeah, they were hearing and it matched the profile of the real voices. One thing, they're like sharks that can smell blood. They can smell negative emotional energy. And they can, people who have been badly abused are programmed in a negative fashion and they put out negative energy. And that's what these things feed off of, is negative emotional energy. They mostly hit around the age of 25. That's the most common age that they attack people. And I don't know why that is, I have no idea, but it's consistent. Somewhere around the age of 25, they hit. And that's when the first psychotic break is. They run very particular patterns, and those patterns are always negative. So that's one of the things I noticed, is here's psychiatry and psychology who've been programmed to believe that the voices are hallucinations, labeling the voices as hallucinations, you know, auditory and visual hallucinations. Now, hallucinations are random. They're all over the place. They're positive, negative, they're gray, they're neutral, they're everything. There's no pattern to hallucinations. When you start looking at the voices, and they run in very specific patterns, and psychiatry won't even take the time to listen to these guys. So there's, you know, since the inception of psychiatry, patients have been trying to tell them, millions of patients, they are not hallucinations, they're very real. Oh no, they're hallucinations, man. You know, we know they're hallucinations, and you I'm telling you, they're hallucinations. That's what they are. You know, and it's due to a chemical brain imbalance. It's due to what your mother did to you. You know, it's due to all these stupid things, none of which have any backing or support.
The difference is, goes back to that degree. You know, we're going to tell you what to do because we got the degree, right?
That's right. They got the degree. They're going to tell you what to do. They're going to tell you what your illness is. They're not going to listen to anything you have to say about it because you're nuts. You know, you're psychotic. You're schizophrenic. You're nuts. You've got nothing to teach us. You've got nothing to say. Listen to us. We'll tell you what it is. And what we're telling you it is it's an auditory or visual hallucination due to all these factors that we have no proof for. But we're not going to tell you that, you know. And tell you the truth, a lot of them don't even know. I know psychiatrists that had no idea that the chemical imbalance theory was false because that's what they've been taught in medical schools because that's what the drug companies paid the academics to teach them. So it starts all the way from Congress, which the drug companies have virtually complete control of. If you looked at the news recently, the Democrats just voted down a drug expense control bill. They want no interference with their monetary stream for drugs. None. They're selling $3.7 billion of antipsychotic drugs every single year that is rotting out the peripheral nervous system of these patients that have horrible, terrible side effects that change their personality completely and cure nothing, cure absolutely nothing.
And are absolutely crimes against humanity. These are crimes against people on our planet. It's to what end? You know, to what end is there?
Well, it's control and money. You look at the control that a psychiatrist has over mental institutions, over the medical units of prisons. It's control. It's just virtual. Anybody who dares stand up to a psychiatrist who is below them in the mental health system will end up fried. You know, I had to creep under their radar for years, and I had some horrendous battles with some of them who tried to get me fired. And if it wasn't for my boss protecting me, they would have got me more than once.
Terry, do you want to jump in there?
Hi. Yeah, I have a quick question. I'm curious as to, Jerry, if you've seen in any of the patients that being sexual, if that's has had any impact on whether these entities are coming in then or they become stronger. But when a teenager, you know, the hormones kick in and the sexual energies then start to come in, does that have in play at all with, you know, these voices and entities?
Let's see how to put this. Well, in one way, yes, because it's thinking to kind of gets that stuff going. Now, what I have seen is both males and females that are sexually attacked by these things, these voices. I remember one gal who was a top salesman for a furniture company who came into the ER saying, you know, the voices are raping me and it's happening all the time and I can't function and I have to go into the back storage room until this is over. Finally, we ended up admitting her. Males, I remember in the prison, one prisoner came in and says, I'm being raped by this female. And she doesn't ever say anything. She just pants. And she touches me all over. And it's constant. And I remember the first thought I had come through my mind was, well, you know, if the other prisoners found out about this, you would be the envy of the entire prison yard. And he goes, no, it's not like that. If it happens all the time, constantly, always, and it never stops, it's like hell on earth. You know? So, yeah, there are sexual attacks by these things, and these people actually experience them. As a matter of fact, I was reading one account yesterday of one lady who was hearing these things, and she was in love with them and said the sex was better than it was with humans, and she was trying to have a ghost baby with these things. So, yeah, it can get out of hand, but you know, most teenagers, that they have those hormones raging and they're doing stupid stuff and they're not psychotic, but they can get in a lot of trouble that way. There was one, I remember this was a strange one. This was a prisoner who told me that he was in one of the local bars that, you know, I'd passed a million times and I'd look at him. It was some pirate bar that it was in the shape of a pirate boat. And he went in there one day and he was hearing voices and here's all these women in there and guys, and it was, you know, regular, you know, sleaze bucket bar. And the voices were telling him, that woman over there, that one. And so he went over there, started a conversation with her, and the voices were telling him, well, bring her home. Apparently she'd like to be, have sex and also be choked at the same time, which was bizarre. So here she was being choked out while he's having sex with her, and she liked this somehow. And he choked her to the point where she was unconscious. And that scared the daylights out of him. And he was telling me about this. So, yeah, the voices will pick out women in some cases. And, you know, I wouldn't be surprised if a lot of these women that went missing were murdered by people who were hearing voices. But, you know, the average teenager that's, you know, have raging full hormones and, you know, looking at Playboy magazines and that kind of stuff, it's not the same thing.
Yeah, well said. And I think we mentioned that in the first interview, you know, the whole pornography industry and all of that. And wow, I mean, just imagine running amok with all of those entities and all of that feeding frenzy that's going on. Anything out of the sacred or the divine, you know, is targeting. And of course, they don't like whole male-female relationships either. Because
they don't like any relationship.
They don't like anything that is pure and of the highest expression of love. Yeah.
It's toxic to them.
Yeah, absolutely. Amy, would you like to, do you have anything to share? Would you like to ask Jerry a question?
Hey, Jerry. I was wondering, because I've spent some time in and out of mental hospitals personally, and where they've drugged me to the point where I didn't have control of myself. And then going back into some hypnotherapy sessions, I discovered that I was taken to underground places across the United States where they would do experiments on me there. And I was wondering if you had any patients ever that talked about abductions or anything like that?
I personally haven't, but boy, I tell you, I get a lot of emails from patients or people who have. You know, they're talking about, what are they, MK Ultra, where they take them and they drug them and they brainwash them and they get them to where they can give them a command and they'll go do it unconsciously, kind of like a hypnosis. I remember watching a stage hypnotist once, you know, he would give this command and everybody would fall asleep or everybody would act like they were frozen or something to that effect. So yeah, I've gotten a lot of email from those people who say, yeah, the MK Ultra and the shady part segments of government are doing this kind of stuff.
Mill apps and UFO and other kind of anomalous paranormal trauma that's part of this. I think a lot of us here can speak to those kinds of experiences as well. It's unbelievable what we're exposed to, and it's unbelievable. But yet, the human spirit, we're so powerful and we're so amazing and we're so divine that even with all of those experiences, somehow we find our way through, right? And it's by going within and seeking the answers and not being afraid to look at the pain. You said something here, Van Dusen said something about healing. I love your book because it's so good. It's all marked up and pages are turned, but Van Dusen said something in page 101 is that was talking about the usefulness of the voices, which we know they're not, but they do in some way inspire those who have the ability to take their personal power to investigate deeper within themselves to find a way out of that disorder. And Van Dusen said the the higher order itself has indicated that the usefulness of the lower order is to illustrate and make conscious the patient's weaknesses and faults. The fact is that the voices are energetic parasites. They utilize negative events from the patient's memory against them. The only useful thing about this is they're going after unhealed traumas buried alive that the patient must work on or forgive to heal themselves. And that's very powerful because all of us are on a self, every single one of us on this call are on that journey of self-healing and awakening or awareness.
So right? Before Van Dusen died, I worked with him for a year, 2 years, because he was the only one that understood besides Sherry. And I met him before I met Sherry because I read his book, when he labeled The Presence of Other Worlds, I think he named it. He had one chapter in there where he saw that the voices were doing the same things that Emanuel Swedenborg, who lived 700 years ago, a Christian mystic. Swedenborg was describing evil spirits that talked and acted just like the voices that Van Dusen was encountering with his patients. So the difference between what I did and what he did is he tried to make friends with the patient's voices. And he would carry on long conversations with them, trying to figure out what they were and what they knew and how they behaved. And he basically didn't get very far. And so they were always suspicious of him. But he would carry on long conversations with the voices and conversations that not even his patients understood between him and the voices, especially the higher voices, which some of his patients did experience. Positive voices, but that usually the positive ones don't speak in words. They speak in feelings and intuition, and they don't force themselves on people, and they don't make them do things, and they don't run them down. They offer you, it's kind of like, okay, take a look at this. You want to do that, you can move in this direction, but they won't force you to do something. Or they won't barge in and take over your consciousness.
You know, that's so interesting because I always like, you know, when you're first waking up or you're doing some self-inquiry work for inner healing and you see all these synchronicities everywhere. There's a synchronicity there. There's another one there. Look at that. Wow, that's amazing. I must be being guided and led. And I'm thinking, okay, no. Hold steady. Go to your core and really assess if you're being led, right? By that force that doesn't have your best interests at heart, or if it's truly of a divine way in which to move. So discernment, 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 right? Because not all sinks are good sinks, you know, as you learn.
Well, you know, at the root of it is how and what you think and what, you know, what are our thoughts, where do they come from, and your awareness of them. I mean, they're, I don't know if I told you this story, but there was one time toward the end of my 7 years at the state hospital where, you know, I was really suspecting that these things were not hallucinations. But I didn't want to believe that. You know, I was in denial. So I went home and I prayed and I said, Lord, let me experience these so I know what they are. You know, just let me have a taste of what they are. 2 weeks later, what I did is when I got home from the state hospital, I lived on a lake in Georgia, and I'd go out swimming after dark because no motorboats were there. The water was calm. It was warm in the summer. And one night I headed out into the lake, maybe at 8 o'clock at night, and I was a good swimmer. I always loved the water. I was a scuba diver. I had a half a year of skin diving and a half a year of scuba diving as an undergraduate. And so I knew my way around the water. I wasn't afraid of the water. It was my friend. And I headed out, hit my stroke, and it was like meditation. And, you know, I was just cutting through the water and concentrating on stroke. And after a while, I got tired. Well, where am I? And I looked up and I was way in the middle of the lake, way in the middle of the lake. And I'm looking around and it's dark and here's all the lights on the shore. And here comes this thought. You know, And it goes, well, you're too far to make it back and too tired, which was true. Like, I was too tired to make it back, but I wasn't worried about it. I didn't know what to do about it. And it goes, and the lights are gone out on the shore. And you're going to get disoriented because you're not going to know where the shore is. You know? And it was true. The lights were going out on the shore. There was one other thing that was going on that was true. And all of these were true. And then it kicks in. I'm going, well, that's true, that's true, that's true. And I'm thinking, this is my thoughts, and it's my thought process. And then it kicks in and goes, and you're going to drown. Now, that wasn't my thought. You know? And I noticed it was a yes set, like the salesmen do too. Oh, you love this thing, don't you? Well, it can clean your house in no time. You know? You won't have to work. Oh, you know, all these things, yes, 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 yes. And then he kicks in, oh, you'd love to buy it, wouldn't you? Well, yeah. Only this thing saying, oh, and you're going to drown. And that was the last thing on my mind. That was not my intent. It wasn't my thought. And I knew it wasn't my thought. And I'm like, where did that come from? So what they taught us to do was something called, you know, it's like a dead man's float kind of thing where you put your hands behind your back. And you take a big, deep breath, and your face is underwater, and you're just floating with your hands down, and you're just floating like Batman. And when you run out of air, you whip your head up real fast, you blow out all the air, and suck in another full breath of air, and you sink. And while you let out the air, you're negative, and you start dipping below the surface, and then you pop back up again, and you float like a dead man for a while. And if the water's warm, you can do that for days if you need to. So that's how you rest up in the middle of nowhere. And the water's got to be pretty rough for you not to be able to do that. But this night, it was just glass smooth water, bath warm water. It was just, I could have done that all night if I had to. So while I was sinking, here comes this thing again. And it goes, hey, you're too far out. You're too tired to make it back to the shore. You're sinking toward the bottom. You're going to drown. And I'm like, what? And I was sinking toward the bottom. Pop back up. I come back up. Take my breath of air. And I'm face back down the water. And here it is again. You're too far down. You're too far out. You're running that scenario again. And you're going to drown. So the next time when I went up for air, when I sunk down, I let some air out. So I would sink further. And so I was like fighting whatever this thing is. I already sensed it wasn't me, but I didn't know what it was. It wasn't me, and I didn't like it, and I was going to spite it. All the way down to the bottom of the lake, I was going to spite it. So here it was, maybe 9 o'clock by that time. And you hit what they call the crush deck, where the water pressure collapses your lungs, and you start sinking real fast. So I let the air out, and then all of a sudden I'm like, boom, heading toward the bottom. And I go, whoa, this is a little fast for what's going on. So I shot back up to the top. Here it comes again, same scenario. You're too far out, you're too tired to make it to the shore, you're panicking. I'm panicking? Oh, crap. So I went down again, let out the air, hit the crush depth, kept falling toward the bottom, equalized the pressure in my ear so I didn't blow my eardrums, and kept going down. And then I felt this coldness just coming up my legs. It was moving up my legs toward my body. It was just freezing cold. I'm like, whoa, and shot toward the surface. Even before I got there, I knew it was a thermopond, a layer of cold water that usually lays on the bottom. It sinks past the warm water, and it just sits there. And I've hit it a million times, scuba diving. So I knew what it was, and I get to the surface. Here it is again. Oh, you're too far out. You're too tired. The lights are going on. I look, and more lights are out. And you're panicking, and you're not going to make it back to shore. You're going to drown. And I'm like, what the hell is this thing? And then it goes, and there's a motorboat coming, and it's going to cut you to pieces. But normally, underwater, you can hear sound way far away, much further than on land. And I didn't pick up any motorboat engine. I guess I was too absorbed with whatever this craziness going on. And I look, and here's this motorboat in the distance coming toward me with a green navigation light on. And this thing's going, it can't see you, which is true. And they don't know you're here. They have no idea, which is true. And they're coming right for you, which is true. And they're going to cut you to pieces. That propeller's going to rip you to pieces, and you're just going to be flaming your own lane in the middle of the lake, and you're not going to make it to the shore. I've had to dive under motorboats while I was scuba diving. You know, I hugged the bottom while they went over. So it wasn't anything I didn't know how to do. So I went, come too close, I'll hit for the bottom. I'm all right. You know, so, no, it's going to grind you to death. They're going to go, it's going to cut you to pieces. So I'm watching it, and it's coming, and it's getting closer, and it was maybe 15, 20 yards off. And I watch it as it passes, when I'm paying attention as it passes, and I wasn't paying attention to the wake. So what happens is I'm taking in a lung full of air, and the wake hits just as I'm taking in the air, and my mouth fills with water, and I swallow some, and I start coughing and choking, spitting it back out again, and here it comes. So you're panicking, you're going to drown, you're not going to make it, you're going to look at you can't breathe. And I'm like, what the hell is this thing, you know? So after the boat left, I sunk back down again, sunk past the crypta, went all the way through the thermocline. And what was strange is this thermocline didn't make it all the way to the bottom. There was warm water below it. So it was in the process of sinking. So I passed all the way through that thermocline, hit the bottom, and I felt this icky slime moving up my leg. And I shot for the surface again. And even before I got there, I knew that this was muck from the bottom. But I wasn't expecting muck because all the times I'd been swimming over the years, it was always a rock bottom. So I thought the whole bottom was rock. I didn't know there was slime down there. So I, you know, felt like something was grabbing me and sucking me in. And this was such a strange experience. I was a little bit shook up by it. And I wasn't going to hang around back there until I'd figured it out. So I shot for the surface again. So here it comes again. Well, you're panicking. You're going to die. Same scenario all again. So I sunk back down, back to crush that, through the thermocline, stuck in the mud, my feet stuck in the mud, and it was so soft I couldn't even feel my feet. And I was floating with my knuckles maybe 6 inches above the bottom. And I was waiting for something to come out of the, and it's pitch black. It's close to midnight now. And it's pitch black down there, and the water's bath warm, and I'm floating at the bottom of the lake with my knuckles above the bottom, my feet stuck in the mud. And I was a little bit scared, so I was waiting for something to kind of come out of the darkness and grab me. And in the meantime, what there was total silence. All my senses have been cut off, and I was just aware that I was aware. That was it. That's what's past all this, you know. It's this awareness that you're aware. That's what's there. You know, you take away all this input, all the feeling, the cold, the hot, all the stimulation, all this bullshit you're being hit with all the time with the television. That's what's there. It's just life, the awareness that you're aware. You know? So that's baseline. That's what's there. You know? All this other stuff, these thoughts that come up, those are being pulled from memory and your programming, okay? So anytime you're just thinking, you're running a program that you've been taught to run, and any program will work as long as you're alive. You know, if it got you to the point where you are now, it works. They work to different degrees, but it works. So it works for you. But then you start looking further than that, and you start looking like, okay, what is this awareness? What is actually there? If thoughts aren't innately there, then where do they come from? So they come from your memory, okay? And when your memory's done playing its retinue, everything is the way you think it is. Everything's copacetic with the world. But if something comes in there like Castaneda's talking about and it doesn't fit, you know, you're either going to pound it in and make a square peg fit into a round hole, or you're going to try to rationalize it away and explain it somehow, which is the biggest thing that happens, or you're going to take Valium, or some other drug that they offer that's going to fit.
Yeah, to further lock down those patterns and programs, just keep you in the box. One of the biggest things I see a lot too, Jerry, when talking to people, because I work with a lot of folks, both with hypnotherapy and with and energy work, and are these repetitive thought loops. Would anybody like to speak to that, Amy? How about you? Because I know that's something that you actually experience.
Well, I found it interesting the way you describe the voices that schizophrenics hear and then the voices that I experienced for 30 years. How they didn't tell me to do crazy things necessarily, although they told me to do a lot of drugs, they would just loop in, you should hate yourself. Everyone hates you. You're awful. You're a terrible person. Mm-hmm. You should die. Why are you alive? And so that would keep me in depression mode. And then it takes so much to break out of one of those loops.
Yes.
It's a lot.
Well, that is not for no reason. And I noticed that too with the patients I work with, both at the state hospital and then when I got into the prison, is those negative loops. Now, you'll notice that once you get into one of those loops, that you're generating negative emotional energy. And that's exactly what these voices are telling schizophrenics, that kind of stuff. And it's a pattern. You would wonder if they were a hallucination, why aren't they random like all other hallucinations? Why do they just keep telling people negative stuff about themselves and everybody else? You're stupid, you're crazy, nobody likes you, nobody loves you, your parents are faking like they like you, you don't have any friends. Just get it over with, can kill yourself. It's all negative stuff. Now, what I saw, and I couldn't explain for years, was that after the voices attacked these patients, they were completely drained. They had no energy whatsoever. They couldn't even get out of bed in most cases. Prisoners couldn't get up to go to breakfast. They were completely drained. And it was like time after time after time after time. So here's another pattern that I saw. And hallucinations aren't supposed to run patterns. Here's all these patterns showing up that psychiatry is just totally ignoring. So what is with that? Where did the energy go? Why are schizophrenics don't have any energy? Why are they depressed all the time? Why, after the voices attack them, do they not have any energy? Where does the energy go? And you ask them and it's like, oh, well, horrible thing. They're saying horrible things. And for years, I thought it was the anxiety that these voices caused that did that. That since these people were under such anxious, that they were so anxious all the time and so fearful all the time, that eventually drained them. But then you turn on any war movie and you see people in combat and they're not, they're anxious and they're worried and they're scared to death and they're still functioning, they're still fighting, and they're flying fighter planes and doing all this complex stuff with bullets ripping through the canopy. One time I got called over. I always got assigned to the worst units, and I was a pretty adrenaline junkie, and back then I loved it. So for me it was a thrill, and I got assigned to the jail for the prison complex. So this is where the worst of the worst went. If somebody screwed up in one of these other units, the high custody unit, they would send them over to the jail, and I was in charge of psych services for the jail. So there was one day where I walked into my office one morning, and here is a letter, an inmate letter from one inmate who was locked into this tiny cell with a floored psychotic inmate, another inmate. And this guy was crazy as a bedbug. He was hearing voices. He was standing over this guy at 3 a.m, staring down at him. He's paced the floor all night. He was acting bizarre. And here's this other guy trapped in this little cell with him. And then I get a letter from the commander of that unit saying, you need to come over here and do something about that guy, the crazy guy, get him medicated or something because he's driving his cellmate nuts. I went over there and they were both locked into the same cell, which is, I would say, maybe 10 by 10, that's it, with a bathroom in there, and that was it. They're locked in there 24 hours a day, except for one day to get out, and they put them in a cage where they can get an hour's worth of sunshine. So I pulled them out one after another, and I pulled the first guy out. He was the same guy, and looked up his record before I went over there. And what happened is he had snitched off one of the drug gangs. I forgot which one it was, but it was one of the big gangs, the Aryan Brotherhood it was. And they had been busted by the administration because he had snitched off their drug deal. Their drugs had been confiscated. Their leaders had been broken up and sent all over the state to different prisons. So that was a real blow to that gang. That was the biggest blow that you could a gang in prison could be dealt with. And they wanted that guy dead. He was a snitch, and they wanted him dead. They wanted him dead so bad that two of their members went and got in trouble so they could be sent over to the central detention unit so they'd have a chance at getting at this guy. And they would shoot these, and I still to this day have no idea how they did it. They tie these little notes on strings, and they would chuck those under the hole in their cell door, and it would travel for maybe 50 feet under the door of a cell across the hallway. And then whoever got it would take the note off, and then they'd pull the string back. It was amazing. I watched it happen once, and it happens in a blink of an eye. Goes, phew, phew, and then it comes back. It's like it all happens in like a second and a half, 2 seconds. It's like unbelievable. So here they are sending him these notes. We're going to kill you. You're a dead man. And they pass by his door. You're done. But as soon as we catch you alone, you're done. They had to put him under protective custody. That's why he was there. So you couldn't be under more stress than that. Here's this guy locked in with the gangsters right outside his cell telling him they're going to kill him the first chance they got his hands on him. And he's locked in with a psychotic, floridly psychotic cellmate who's standing over him at 3 a.m. staring down at him, you know, and who knows what that guy did before he got in there. You couldn't be under much more stress. So I pulled him out one after another, and I interviewed the first guy, the same guy first, and he had plenty of energy. I'm watching his energy level. He's anxious. He's got lots of energy. He wasn't so depressed. His thoughts were slow. His speech was slow. He was anxious. You know, he was like a soldier in battle. He was anxious. He wasn't nuts. He had enough energy to mobilize himself. And I watched as he came up the steps, and he had plenty of, he bounded up the steps into the interview room, and then he went back down again with plenty of energy. Then I asked for the schizophrenic guy to be brought up, and he could barely make it up the steps to the interview room. He just broke himself up the steps, pulled himself up the banister, got in, he sat down, and he was like a rag. And he just could barely speak, and said he was hearing voices all the time, and they were attacking him, and he was having nightmares, and all of this, and he was on Medicaid. So he was raw, and he had no energy. He had no energy whatsoever. So when I was done, those two guys, I walked out of the central detention unit, and I went, no, it's not the anxiety that's causing that drain, that energy drain. That's not it. So I remembered, okay, the war movies, and then I saw it with my own eyes. It's not that. So then what is it? Where does their energy go? And I started asking them. Well, I don't know where it goes. They didn't even realize it until they were told that their energy would leave after the voices attacked. Then a lot of them didn't even recognize that they were missing their energy when the voices left. You know, it was just like that was part of it. They didn't even think about it. Then you ask them, well, where did it go? And they didn't know. They didn't know.
Gary, it's interesting, you know, when you look at the cycles just day to day in our own lives, you have energy, you're feeling pretty good, and then it drops. And if you start to pay attention to your own thought process or where you are, you actually can feel. I mean, I'm aware enough of my own thoughts after many, many years of looking at my thoughts. I can feel the correlation between feeling low or having an off thought to my energy balance and to how I flow through my day, you know.
You can actually experience that with strength testing.
Yeah, muscle testing and things like
muscle
that.
Muscle testing.
Too.
So, mm-hmm. So I'd have these big giant inmates with arms as big as my leg, and I'd have them, you know, in some of the groups I ran, I'd have them hold out your arms straight out like this, and I'd say, think of the best thought you've ever had in your life, the happiest you've ever been, and I'd wrap my little finger around your arm and pull it down. I couldn't pull it down. I'd say, okay, now imagine the worst thing that ever happened to you, the most horrible thing that ever happened to you in your life. You do the same thing and your arm just drops right down. You can't believe it. So any negative stream of thought will weaken and cause you to lose your energy. But I was wondering why that consistently happened with schizophrenics and where it went, and they didn't know. So I would ask Cunningham, where'd your energy go? Well, I don't know. So one day I was reading a book by Miguel Ruiz, I think it was The Four Agreements, where he was talking about these entities actually being parasitic and stealing people's energy, taking it, and that was their food. You know, and that,
and fear that, is the
that's what Castaneda said, and that's what appears to be happening.
Yeah, absolutely. Jordan.
So, Jerry, going back to the lake then, when you sunk to the very bottom and you were feeling that very peaceful onefulness, what was your energetic state at that time?
I had plenty of energy. What surprised me was, that's the first time in my entire life where everything had been cut off, all my senses, my hearing, sight, breathing, everything, all input was cut off, all of it. And what was left was just what was there. I was aware that I was aware. Everything else is a coding. Everything else is thoughts that disturb that and white noise,
right? It's like white noise. And when the static goes away, you're in perfect peace.
Yeah. It's directed. It's the drug companies wanting you to do this. It's the beauty companies wanting you to do that. It's that you're somebody wanting you to do this or that. It's just this onslaught. But what you are is a divine being. And that's what's there. You're alive.
Perfect peace. Perfect love.
That wasn't so much perfect peace because I was a little bit scared being at the bottom of the lake at midnight with all this weirdness going on. You know,
yes.
I was waiting for something to jump out of the darkness and grab me. And where is it? Okay. Yeah, where is it? Yeah. I didn't know that they could grab you back then. If I knew that, I would have been a lot more scared, but they can and I have been.
Thank you for sharing, Jerry. Amazing. That's an amazing.
I just wanted to also say, sorry, Terry, that I feel that I've experienced that. Mm-hmm. I've experienced satanic ritual abuse in my life. And what I came to that one point also that empowered me, and this happened to me as a child, so I was looking to outsources of adults, you know, who were trying to guide me at that time. And then when you bring in the SRA on top of that. So these are adults doing this to me. But there was a point in my life when I experienced, just even as a child, having this horrific experience that I felt that calmness, that peace, that oneness. Now I would put that into saying it was my own super conscious connected with and into God's source or the God source that I am. And then from that point, this is how I was able to see myself in a completely different light and to be able to pull myself out of any other situation that they were going to put upon me. And this I feel is a God-given right to everyone. We've had these systems so put upon us that in any horrific situation, I think it's important for us to know that these situations do not need to make us who we are, but that we're something completely different. And if we can access into that complete consciousness, that peace, that knowing, self-empowerment is more of a quiet peacefulness of being who you are in a state of knowing, where I feel the other is wanting to just bring you into fear where, you know, they're going to be able to use that energy. So to me, there's I'm hoping that you would agree with it, with that experience of all of your experience, that's where we all need to be at some point and place in our lives, is to be able to realize that depth of who we are and to just take that back. You know, we don't need to go out and riot and, you know, and all of this stuff. We'll just stand peacefully in who we are no matter what happens to us.
I know exactly what you're talking about, but I was so dense that it took three times, or it took once for you, it took three times for me to experience that. And it was like spirits sneaking up behind me with a baseball bat and whacking me over the head. And the most profound one of the three, and again, this didn't fit into any, it was unreal. It was just totally unreal, like it was with you. It was when I was going for my commercial pilot license in gliders, sailplanes. And we were having to do precision landings, which means that you have 250 feet to drop that plane out of the air, drive the nose skid into the ground, so it was actually plowing a furrow in the ground and the tail's up like this. And it had to stop within that 250 feet, otherwise you failed the test. You had to be able to do this. And it was hard enough trying to figure out, you know, okay, what's my speed need to be, what my altitude needs to be, what's my descent rate needs to be. You got all this stuff going through your head, trying to figure out how to drop that plane out of the air right on that first cone and have it stop by the second. And even with a clear view, that was very difficult. So one day we're walking out to the plane, we're going to practice these emergency landings, and the instructor said, "You're flying from the back seat today." And I went, "What are you talking about? I can't see anything past your fat head in the back seat." They're like, "I can't see the runway." "You're flying from the back seat." And I'm going, "What's with this guy?" You know, so I'm not going to have to take the test from the back seat. I'll be in the front seat where I can see what's going on. "You're flying from the back seat." I'm like, "Ah, geez, what is wrong?" So I'm pissed off, getting in the thing, getting in the back seat, run the pattern, coming on final approach. And I always carried a little more airspeed and altitude than I needed, because in a sailplane, you can't get that back. You can always lose it real fast. I mean, you can drop out of the air like a rock, you pop those dive brakes and you're heading for the ground, but you can't get it back. So I'm carrying a little more airspeed and working that down, because I can't be too fast when I get to that cone. I have to be at stall speed when I hit the cone. I'm carrying a little more altitude. I know that. I know what I need to do to get rid of it. I'm coming in on final approach, and he goes, "Where are you?" I said, "I'm high." And he goes, "Let me have it." So that means he's taking controls. He's taking the controls of the plane. By federal law, I got to turn it over to him. But I'm sitting there going, "What the hell are you taking the controls for? Now I can't even practice the landing. What is he doing? Why did he take control of the plane? Why am I flying from the front seat? What the hell is going on?" So I'm sitting there going, "What is he doing? Why did he do that?" The next thing I know, he stalls the airplane on final approach. So here we are 150 feet above the ground, and that thing's heading down at a 45-degree angle. Stalled. It's not flying anymore, and the dive brakes are full out. And I look out at the wings, and the dive brakes are full out. He's not going to gain control of that plane until those dive brakes are put back in again. And I'm looking at him, and he's just sitting there rigid. You know, I see the back of his head, and I'm going, "Did he have a heart attack? Does he have a stroke? What's going on with him? Why isn't he flying the plane? We're going to crash in about 10 seconds or 15 seconds here if he doesn't do something." So he's not doing anything. So I go, "He's not going to regain control of this plane unless those dive brakes are in." So his name was Jerry, too. I said, "Jerry, I'm putting in the dive brakes." So I jam the dive brakes in and lock him in. And he's still not doing anything. So I look at the plane, and we're not lined up with the runway anymore. We're off on the right-hand side and heading for a Palo Verde tree. We're heading right into this tree, and he's still not flying the plane. Now, while that's happening, I had the same exact feeling you had, Jordan. I'm looking around. We're low. We're about to hit this tree. He's still not flying the plane. We're not lined up with the runway anymore. The runway we were lined up on, it's only like 35 feet wide. You can't land a sailplane on that. It takes 250 feet, and that's when you're digging a hole in the runway, in the dirt runway. You can't stop the plane in that amount of time. And on the other side of that perpendicular part of the runway was a ditch and a big mound of dirt. So even if he does manage, and in front of that is a barbed wire fence. So here we are. I'm looking out, and we're heading for this Palo Verde tree, still not flying the plane. I look over, here's this barbed wire fence, and we're low. And here's the runway, 23 to 30 so feet. We can't land. We're not going to stop on that. And then the ditch and the mound. There's no way we're going to survive this. None. Not unless he lands out in the desert somewhere. And then finally he starts flying the plane. And I'm like, and I got that same feel that you did. It's this complete feeling of peace. You know, it was like everything is going to be okay. You know, and I knew that. I mean, it was this knowing that was beyond all doubt. It was just this complete knowing. There wasn't a doubt in my mind that everything was going to be fine. But it couldn't be. It just couldn't be. I'm looking out, and he hits the tree, and he starts turning as he hits the tree, and here's this big branch goes right by my window outside of the plane. I see it spin by, and he turns the plane toward the barbed wire fence, and we're way low now, and hitting that tree took more energy out of the plane. I'm watching this barbed wire fence come up from the window, and I'm going, we're going to make it. No, we're not going to make it. Yeah, no. Maybe then. No. Yeah, it was, didn't look. I didn't know. We were so low, I didn't know. And if we didn't clear it, that barbed wire, that plexiglass front, with the fiberglass front and that plexiglass canopy, it wasn't going to stop that barbed wire. It was going to cut right through that and cut our heads off. That barbed wire, that 1,000-pound sailplane with us in it, that barbed wire is going to cut right through it like a saw. So it still is that feeling like everything's going to be fine, And it was a knowing, it was this absolute knowing. There was no doubt whatsoever. Everything, but it couldn't be. So we're heading for the barbed wire fence. And he barely clears that thing. Now, I flew with this guy for many years in Civil Air Patrol. I flew with them for 23 years, and I flew with him a lot of that. He wasn't that great a pilot, especially for what he pulls off. So we just clear that barbed wire fence, barely. He hits full right rudder, and the whole plane turns sideways. So it's now, the side of the plane is now facing into the air, and it's no longer flying. It's like a giant air brake, and it just drops straight out of the air right onto the runway, which didn't make sense because it still had sideways motion. It should have hit and then slammed the wing down into the ground. It didn't do that. It just landed, bam, straight up, and it just balanced there, which is unreal. It just balanced there, and it hit so loud it threw this cloud of smoke 50 feet into the air.
Jerry, thank you for sharing that, because I'm going to have Julie speak again to express, because we're talking about divine intervention now. So all the voices and all the negativity that we have this divine inspiration that is truly there. Also, at the same time, I feel more powerful than anything that the dark can throw at us. And Julie, if you don't mind, maybe you can add to your experience of what happened with your, we need to hear. Yeah, there you go. Thank you.
I don't know where to start, but I definitely recognize with the peace component, and I'm just trying to figure out where to start about everything.
Perhaps, Julie, where you had your, where the dissection happened, and then the experience of being in that vision. It's powerful. You okay?
Yeah. It never goes away. So I had an out-of-body experience, a near-death experience, and it was extremely powerful because I was drowning, and I didn't understand what was happening, and I was surrounded by what I knew was evil. And the voice was telling me, and everything was telling me it was evil, and but I didn't listen because I'm like, I'm not submitting to evil. I'm not gonna go down. I don't know. I don't know where it came from. Like, I knew I was so much more than I ever knew as a human, and so the short version is I didn't listen to the evil voice, and I was defiant actually to the evil voice and stood my ground, and I'm like, I know what I did, and I know what I'm gonna do, and I know that I'm not staying here. And at that moment that I basically rebelled and defied, I experienced the most excruciating pain that I ever could imagine. It was like my chest was cracked open. And at once my chest, like, you've got to feel the pain. It's like, it wasn't just like a quick crack open. It was like, it was torn and ripped and cracked apart, where you're filled with pain. And then I was
despined from the tailbone up. It's like having every nerve, every electrical, every everything taken out of your body. And it was excruciatingly painful. However, the light on the side of that is that as soon as I was just like paralyzed by the pain, I immediately found myself like floating, and I was looking into the eyes, and for me, looking back now, I feel that I was surrounded by God Source, and it was just personified in a human shape to where I could comprehend it best, but it was looking into the eyes and the cheekbones of the most loving, caring light energy that there ever could be. And the most calm came over me, and it was a calm that not a human calm, an earth calm. It was a calm from every cell inside of your body that everything is okay. Everything is peaceful. Everything is love. Everything is light. And for the first time in my life, I felt connected and at home. And it really resonated with me. And even now, why I feel so disconnected down here on this planet, because when I was floating and looking into her and we were speaking telepathically, and I just was surrounded by so much love, and I understood how interconnected we all are and how everything here on this planet is not the reality. It's not. We've been cut off. We've been misguided, we've been programmed, we've been misled. And for the first time, just to feel the connection, I was just so thankful. I was like, I knew I wasn't wrong. I knew I wasn't weird. I knew, like, this is what I had been searching for. And fortunately, in conversing like telepathically with this beautiful energy source, it was just, she told me, she's like, you had to go through the pain to find your peace. And I was going to be okay. And it was very beautiful. You know, she said that it was going to matter what I did when I came back home, meaning like back to this planet, to this earth, into my body. That was going to affect my future. But that if I made the right decisions and I followed my path, I going through this painful experience, I would find my peace. I didn't want to leave, but it was one of those things. It's like you connect with Source and it's like, all right, I'm going back in. And I remember coming back to the planet, coming back to the body. And I can honestly say that I forgot about this for a couple of weeks after, when I was home healing and I was talking with a friend who's very spiritual and open-minded, and just we have some kind of history together as far as just like an energetic history, and it all came flooding back to me. And I feel like I was extremely blessed, because every morning before my body would awake, I had an awareness about me, and kind of like Jerry said, I was aware that I was aware. And before my eyes opened, before anything was firing, I'm aware that I'm aware and I'm alive. And then it's like, okay, well then that means I didn't die last night in my sleep. Okay, well that means, you know, like what she said, that I'm going to be okay. And I really felt like it gave me insider information and a lot of hope and faith for my healing process. The 6 months that I was home, because I had a lot of complications, and you know, so I can tell you that it was just an amazing experience, and I really feel like I will always be emotional to discuss it and to share it, because of the amount of emotion and power. And one thing with the people that I have shared the experience with is that I don't know what it's like to do psychedelic drugs or any of these things, but it's like, you can't even beg to have this level of connection and love and light, and because there's not words in our language to explain it. There's no way to explain when every cell in your body is alive and there's energy pulsing through it, and the energy is love and the energy is light, and you feel limitless and connected. I mean, it's the most beautiful feeling I've ever experienced. And I mean, I can honestly say too, now that when people lose their lives or they're in a different place or a loved one is going to pass, or even now for me, when I know when it's time for my animals that I'm so connected with, that I know that they're going to something way more beautiful, and it's, any tears are more like tears of joy for them. It's like, you're going to be so happy. You can't even imagine. So it's been a blessing to me, and I hope that I can share that message or at least help people that have recently lost someone, something, to let them know that that soul is part of us, is part of you, and it's connected and it's very happy and very loved.
Well, there's a number of people on YouTube who are speaking out on the same thing, that have experienced something similar to what you have.
Really?
They're all over the place. You look at what society does, they keep you focused outside of yourself. You know, always, you know, buy this, buy that, do this, do that. They don't want you looking inside. And all the 4 years undergraduate psych and 4 years of graduate psych, no spiritual anything to any of it. It was as spiritually dry as the friggin' Sahara Desert.
Jerry, I have somebody has a question to ask you just about that. Donna and Julie, thank you so much. I'm just kind of watching our time a little bit, and we'll get to everybody for our question. But I know Donna had something to ask Jerry about that very thing. And Julie, I love you. Thank you. Thank you so much for sharing that.
So that was a good segue. Can you hear me?
Yeah.
Okay. So my nephew is going into his first year of college, and he wants to go do psychiatry and psychology. And what advice can I give him from you?
Don't do it. Don't do it. They really don't know anything. You know, I would think, looking back on it, I mean, all the torture I had to go through all those 8 years of school, probably the single most useful thing was experimental psychology, or the rat lab, where you do this and this behavior comes about. And that's what should happen. You could see it with dogs and people and everything else, but with schizophrenics, it didn't happen. The advice I'd give him would be go into social work. The psychiatrists are glorified pill pushers. I mean, all the institutional ones that I know, and that's scores of them, all they do is dish out drugs. They spend virtually no time with the patient, and they know they're really not helping anything. Those drugs are toxic. They have nasty side effects, and that's what they're doing. You're hearing voices here. Take this. The anti-anxiety agents that they have out now, I tried one of those once because I couldn't sleep. You talk about being relieved of the burden of consciousness. I didn't get back to normal for 2 days after that. I was like, yeah, what is that stuff? And it's a little teeny weeny pill. I forgot what they call it.
Packs a punch. Thank you, Jerry. It's those little teeny weeny pills pack a punch. I can't take cough medicine like over the counter. It would knock me out for a week.
Ambien? Was it Ambien?
No, it wasn't Ambien. It started with a T. It wasn't trazodone. It was something else.
Tramadol?
What was it?
Tramadol?
No, tramadol is a narcotic. I mean, I could find it, but you certainly wouldn't want to take it. That teeny weeny thing. I mean, it was so tiny, it was unbelievable.
Thank you, Jerry. Thank you, Donna. And Ian, if there's anything you'd like to share or ask Jerry, it would be wonderful to hear from you.
Can you hear me now?
We can hear you. Yeah.
Thank you so much, Jerry, and thank you, Terry, for hosting. Jerry, I just read your book last week, and it was an incredible read. And it was only maybe 4 months ago when I first met Terry, and when a bit of spiritual work I'd been doing sort of got to this point where this much larger truth has revealed itself to me. So I guess I'm still pretty new to this world, and so I'm still settling into it, and it's a lot to absorb. And sometimes I feel like I wrap my head all around it, and other times everything just seems, oh, really, it's just really happening. It's so big.
Keeps doing that too.
But one of the first things that, or one of the, I mean, Terry said to me, I think in our first conversation, you know, she said, not all thoughts are your own. And that really stuck with me since that day. And there's been two or three incidences since then that I'll just share really briefly, just because it's good to share and get them off your chest. But I mean, since then, there's been a couple of moments when I've been very, very, I don't think I've had these little thoughts, you know, all my life that have popped out of nowhere. I mean, I was reading in your book, you know, you mentioned, you know, we all occasionally experience a bone-chilling negative thought suggesting that we do or say something absolutely unconscionable, something we would never even consider. I know, I get emotional, but I was walking down the beach, you know, 2 weekends ago. I woke up early, I live at the beach. It was 4:30 in the morning. I was walking down the beach and I was just strongly looking at the stars, and I noticed someone, a man standing, I think he had his back to me, I think it was on his phone, but it was just, I could make out a shape in the pre-dawn light. And it wasn't a voice per se, this was my thoughts. It sounded like my thoughts, but it said, kill him now, strangle him, come from behind, strangle him, murder him, you'll get away with it. There's no one here.
See, that's what surprised me, is they sound just like your regular thoughts, the thousands of thoughts you have in your head every day.
Yeah.
But the intent is something that doesn't match you at all.
And I think all through my life, little things like that had come up. And I think, like you say in the book, I think you mentioned people just feel a bit embarrassed by it, or they forget about it. You know, most people don't act on it. And I suppose, again, one of my questions for you was, you know, someone like me who has had and does still have things like this pop up. And now, thanks to great advice, I know exactly what it is, and I'm not concerned about it. But for a schizophrenic or someone that's, you know, is in the system, is being medicated now, they will hear, my question to you is, one of my questions, do they hear, they will have these, they hear, it sounds to them like a separate voice. It doesn't sound like their thought, because this was my voice in my mind, my thought, but simply something that you wasn't my, do they hear a different voice?
Well, for the most part, it sounds just like what you experienced. And it sounds like their voice. But when they get stronger, then that starts to change. And what's odd is that when they get really strong, they go after control right away. Almost like the communist Chinese, they want control and they want as much of it as they can get. When they feel they've got control and they don't have to worry about losing it anymore, a lot of times they'll move outside of the patient's head and talk to him from outside his body, like a discarnate voice. They've just out of nowhere been talking to him. Now that's bone chilling, that's really scary. At that point, the patient has to realize that these things are not their thoughts. But by then, it's way too late.
Right. So it starts out the same way for everyone, but it'll just, once it gains strength, it can take on its own form. So that was the other question I had was, essentially, these are, you know, you described these as parasitic entities that feed off the negative emotion.
Negative emotional energy.
So do you have a sense of whether these entities, do they attach themselves permanently to one human, or do they move around? And well, regardless of your answer to that, why do you think that they encourage suicide? Because if they're successful in that, then they will lose the source of the negative energy.
I wondered that myself for a long time. One of the reasons they encourage suicide is because that's a very emotional, wrenching consideration. You know, if you're thinking about killing yourself, that's not easy. And it requires a lot of negative emotion to be generated. And a lot of these people try to kill themselves a number of times before they finally succeed. And it's emotionally wrenching. And I wondered that myself. And I have actually talked to some patients who were about to kill themselves and their voices stopped them. That happened rarely.
Voices stop them from killing themselves.
Voices actually stopped them. Now, there were a lot of other cases where the positive entities came in and stopped it, and intervened into a suicide attempt that just shouldn't have, I mean, it should have just wiped the person out. What I'm thinking is that if they die in that state, that they go on in that state. So they continue in the afterlife in that negative state. And there is really, it's a lot harder to change once you're in a spiritual state. You know, you don't have the instant, you know, tit for tat, or you do something and something happens. The repercussions are a lot slower or not there at all.
Right. They'll create an even more traumatized and tortured soul for the next.
And they're kind of stuck there.
Yeah.
And surrounded by other negative spirits. And it's just like the prison. You know, there's very little positive influence in the prison. You're worried about your life all the time. People are testing you. They're seeing what they can get away with, how much they can, what they can take you for. It's like you're constantly having to watch out, and not just the prisoners, the staff too. Trying to move in a positive spiritual direction when you're surrounded by constant threats and negativity is much more difficult than when you're not.
So it was interesting when you talked about how at some point you, I think it was when you went for your swim, prior to that you said you'd sort of, you'd like to hear these voices to yourself. Did you say that? So you sort of invited them in, or you'd open?
I just asked that I could experience them. And what really shocked me was it sounded just like it did to you. It sounded like any of the millions of thoughts that go through my head in a normal day. It sounded just like that.
Yeah. You know,
there wasn't any change in timbre or strength or tone or anything. It sounded just, you know, like me talking to me, only, you know, like for you, strangle this guy. For me, it was one day I was out chopping cactus in my backyard with a machete, and my dog comes by and it goes, chop its head off. And I'm just had the same reaction you did, but I knew what it was. I knew that wasn't me. But as a rule of thumb, generally, any negative thought about yourself or anybody else is them putting those thoughts in your head and trying to get you to react to them. They do not want you to have friends. They don't want you to have family. They want you isolated. They want to be in control. They want you distracted. They want you focused outside. They don't want you studying any spiritual anything. They don't want you reading the Bible. They don't want you going to church, which is one of the patterns that I saw when I was working at the state hospital. The schizophrenics stayed at home when the chaplain had a ice cream social. They didn't want to go. All the other patients are, oh, yeah, ice cream, candy. Well, yeah, we're going. Not the schizophrenics. So I started, well, why? Well, I never did like preachers. There is no God. And then I found out that there was a pattern that they tried to read the Bible. The voices kicked up and started telling them all kinds of stuff. Oh, that's a bunch of crap. Or what makes you think Jesus could save you? He couldn't even save himself, was what one of the voices told one patient. And these guys fell into three groups.
Sorry, I was just going to say, I'm glad that you said that, because that was actually one other question that I had, my last question that I had for you was, you know, at what point is there a line? Is there a line between just negative thoughts that we have that are our own, that come from our own negative ego, and then is there a line beyond which there are the negative thoughts or the voices coming in from these negative entities? But you said, and it was what I thought must be right, is that why would we have any negative thoughts about ourselves at all? So are all negative thoughts not our own, and they just can be very subtle to extreme and telling us to kill someone or rape someone?
Well, what they're after is a generation of negative emotional energy, which is what they feed off. So my reaction when I got the chop the head off your dog thing was, you know, I was horrified. I started to, how could you even think such a thought? So I started feeling guilty. I was upset that I could even think such a thought, and it upset me for a while. And although I knew I would never do anything like that, it was still upsetting. You know, it just barged in there and hit, and So what they're after is the generation of that negative emotional energy. And if you'll notice with people, unlike any other animal on the planet, they do something wrong, they get into trouble, and it just goes over and over and over, just what do they call it, remunerative. You know, you're kicking yourself, and why did I do that? Why did I say that? How? What are they thinking? What are they going to say? What did I do? And it goes on and on and on and on and on. But that doesn't happen with any other animal on the planet. These things have complete access to your memory. They can pull up every rotten thing you've ever done. And if something comes up in the environment that even resembles that, they can jump in there and go, hey, I remember the time you did this. And they start rubbing it in your face and then until you get upset. And then they drain that energy. So that one patient I was talking about, when I brought in the book by Miguel Ruiz, where he was talking about these entities sucking their energy. And I read this to this one guy I was working with. The whole office erupted with this electrical crackling. I mean, it was just like an arc welder. It just went up the wall one side, across the ceiling, and down the other, and it lasted for 25, 30 seconds. And I'm just shocked. He gets up at the end of that and goes, I gotta leave. And I'm like, yeah, get out of here. Go. And it was like a month or 2 months before I got the nerve to call him back in again. And when I did, I said, you know, there was some small talk, and he looked good. I was expecting him to really be a mess. But he looked good. He had lots of energy. And after the small talk, I asked him, did you hear that crackle in my office the last time you were here? He goes, yeah, but I'm surprised you did. And I'm like, what was it? He said, that was them. He said, voices? And he said, yeah, that was the voices. I said, well, what were they doing? He said, they were trying to scare you. And I said, well, they did a damn good job of it. I was terrified. And
Jerry, I don't want to interrupt you, but we're right at 2 hours. That went like really, really fast.
Wow, yeah,
I just would really love to ask Caitlin if you have any question or any comment or anything you want to share before we go, Caitlin.
I do. Jerry, thank you so much. I have watched several of your interviews in the past. And as we're talking today, so much has kind of been stirred up of my own experiences, but I've also thought, and you kind of touched on it, and about how, and but what I'm thinking of is, or wondering, is it's almost like a knowing that these entities need us more than we don't even need them because of the energy that they feed upon us. And I was just wondering if through your experience, if you would think that, because in what I'm in your past interviews, one thing that really stood out was when you started talking, or when one of your patients discussed the entities, and if certain entities weren't doing their job, the handler would come in, and those ones would be sent to the pit, and how those entities too also have something to fear.
Yeah, there appears to be an organization of them from lowest to highest. And there was one patient told me that the voice they were hearing wasn't destructive enough. And that one was removed and another one was put in their place. So if they don't do that job, or if they're discovered. So they're hard to discover because they do sound just like the thoughts, the everyday thoughts that run through your head, you know? So it's like, okay, how do you tell one from the other? How do you tell what's them and what's not? And the bottom line is the intent of the thought. Is it a negative, destructive thought? Is it a negative thought about yourself or somebody else? And schizophrenics get stuck in that. You know, so here's psychiatry telling them the voices are hallucinations, they're not real. You're crazy, you're a nutcase. You got nothing to tell us. You got to take these toxic meds, and that's all there is. And if you're still hearing the voice, you take more until you turn into a zombie. Then there's a middle group that are kind of caught halfway in between. They're like, well, am I mentally ill, or am I really hearing something? Well, what is really going on? Maybe they sound like they're real, but maybe they're not. I don't know. Then there's the group that knows. They know that these things are evil entities. They know it. They have no doubt in their mind. And here's psychiatry telling them that they're crazy as bedbugs, and they can't tell psychiatry that they're not, because any attempt to do so ends up with them being medicated even more well, your hallucinations are getting stronger, I see. Well, let's give you another dose of this stuff until you're drooling. Then you'll shut up. So psychiatrists closed off any source of investigation. You know, anything that these people could possibly tell them about this other world that they're experiencing. Now, if psychiatry were to look, they would see a number of different patterns that run through these voices that are consistent and predictable and roll off like clockwork. That doesn't happen with hallucinations that are totally random, but they're never going to look and they're never going to believe it. And even if they do look, they won't believe it. And they're being programmed by the big pharma and medical schools and all their psych buddies that if they, we're not going to study hallucination. Are you crazy? Hallucinations aren't real. Why should we waste our time studying them? So that is not a source for this material to get out. It's guys like you who are going to get this material out. It's not going to be psychiatry. It's not going to be the medical people. It's not going to be the academic. It's not going to be the journals. And every person who's tried to put something like this into a journal was attacked viciously, not physically, but mentally. They were run down. Dr. Ömer in Turkey is one case in particular, who watched a shaman cure a number of people with schizophrenics. And all he did was write a journal article saying, hey, the medical faction ought to look at this. This guy's actually got a cure. They attacked him all one side and down the other, man, and attacked the journal he printed in too. So this information isn't going to get out through psychology or psychiatry or colleges or mental health centers or psych hospitals. It's going to get out through people like you who have the light to see and spread this information.
That poses the question, you know, about the system, the death culture of ultimately who benefits. But also seeing simplified when in observing my own experiences in the world that we're living in, it's finite energy versus infinite, and us and who we truly are as infinite divine beings, divine intelligence within. And their greatest fear, the entities being, is for us to wake up.
Exactly.
To realize that.
Exactly.
Yeah.
And that's happening on a mass scale right now. And you can look around and they are going nuts. They are going crazy. You look at what's happening in China. You look what the deep state is doing. You look at the mainstream media broadcast. They sound just like psychotic voices attacking a patient. That's exactly what they sound like. It's getting crazy. They don't want us waking up.
And we are, and it's great. And, you know, we're here. I say, you know, in talking to a lot of people, it's amazing how many of us are having these experiences. And I look at my nephew who passed away in 2008 with a drug addiction. But really looking at his life earlier, you could see from a little boy, there was input there from some external voice and force, right? And I was thinking, as you were saying, you know, the age of 25 seems to be the noticeable onset of these behaviors, but there is input from these entities from the get-go. They are targeting these children, but when you don't have a language to express it as a child or as a parent, you're not understanding what it is. How do you intervene to cut off that connection to these entities for these children so they don't go into full-blown schizophrenia? It's kind of how I think of it. I think that there's parents here on this call too who have an understanding with their children about input from these forces as well. So, you know, it makes you, that's how important it is to really know that not all thoughts are your own and to have dialogue and conversation with people and to pay attention where the input's coming from, because if we have an ability to go to our hearts, you know, be more compassionate, do things that bring us joy instead of ruminating on the pain and the disconnection and the isolation of how we feel here on planet Earth, I think we can circumvent a lot of this full-blown possession. At least that's what I would like to think, you know, that if we're more aware from the get-go and we're teaching our beautiful children early on how to empower themselves, that we can stop this feeding frenzy and generational abuse that comes through our lives.
Sexual abuse, now that they're going after these sexual predators, that is one of the biggest things that damage kids, the sexual and physical abuse. I mean, it's just so damaging, and it just opens the door to these things. And they're getting away with it. Like, I mean, look at Tom Hanks and all these other Hollywood. I mean, this Lolita Express thing, you know, that all these high up politicians are involved with. Those guys have to be brought down.
That's right.
They have to be brought down.
It's time for the darker revelations, for what was unseen is now being seen, you know,
yes.
And it is time to bring that to the foreground so everybody can see what we're up against here. It's now we're over 2 hours, and it's been so fantastic, and the time has gone really, really fast. Jerry, I just appreciate you so much, and I love you for taking the time to come on and to really express truth from your heart and to care so deeply about people and humanity and the plight of our planet and the children. It means so much to me and to everyone here, all of my friends. I just, Amy and Ian and Julie and Donna and Jordan and Caitlin and Terry, I love you, and Lonnie too, who's back there. I just love you all so much, and I'm really grateful that we could all come together to express greater truths. Whether people think we're crazy or not, we're all experiencing it. We all understand something different, and perhaps the compassion we hold in our heart, the truth we speak, will touch another person's life, and we can awaken others as we go. So it's
that kind of feedback to keep Sherry and I going, because we certainly haven't made, we're still in the hole from publishing that book. I mean, we're not making any money on this at all. It's that kind of, and both of us are tired. I mean, both of us have been through a lot.
Yes, I can appreciate that. And again, I just want to hold up your book. So this is your book. And you can go to jerrymarzynski.com. Amy has a book there too. And please, I hope everybody who's watching this would take a time to purchase Jerry's book. It's an amazing read. And so again, thank you so much. And from the bottom of my heart, and I guess I'll see you all again soon. You too, Jerry, I'd love to do it again.
Okay, we can do it again down the line.
All right.
You're all more than welcome. It was a pleasure meeting you all.
Yeah, and thank you so much. And thank you, everybody, for listening. And I appreciate your time. Thank you.
Thank you.